Welcome, you're listening to the Crass Files podcast with Adam. This is part of one of my latest podcast shows with author and researcher Thomas Goodridge, looking at his book Hellstorm and the new audiobook Hellstorm. So we chat about that. If you like what you hear and you'd like to hear the whole podcast or other great podcasts that I'm doing, you can now become a member over on my website, crassfiles.com. Becoming a member gets you access to all my original podcasts and some other great content, and it also helps real brass knuckles independent Australian media. You help me keep my site up and running. I can't do this without you folks, so become a member today at my website, crassfiles.com. All the info's up there and my contact directly via email if you need any support. crassfiles.com.
Hellstorm is, to remind some of your folks and to inform some of your folks, it's what I consider the first comprehensive account of the worst war in human history. I'm sure some folks listening have heard that term, the Good War. Of course, that was coined by a Jew here in America. Not a good war. In fact, Hellstorm is the first comprehensive account of what the war looked like through to the losers, the vanquished of that war, not the victors who constantly, after they've won the war and occupied the nation, write the history and re-educate us on what their approach to the war was or what they thought happened in the war, or what they want us to believe happened in the war. This is the first book to actually describe what the war looked like, the end of the war, that is, and the immediate post-war years looked like to the defeated Germans themselves. And that in itself, when I finished researching the book and writing and rewriting the book, I think the first thing that occurred to me was how all the crimes attributed to the Germans during World War II were actually projections of the American Jewish war effort, that is the Allies. These were projections of their own crimes onto the defeated Germans. That is, those people who could not say no. They had no power to say no. They had no newspapers, no authors, no books, no publishing houses. And so whatever the Allies said that they did, that's the message that stuck with the rest of the world, because that's all the world had, was to read what the victors saw in this war. But what do I mean by projection? Well, thank goodness the human mind is not capable of extreme exaggeration in their imagination. At least mine wasn't. I never, ever would have imagined the things that actually did happen to Germany could ever happen to anyone, but they did. The things that were done to the Germans during and after the war, the first thing that pops to mind is the firebombing of all German cities, over, let's say, 20,000 population, and in some cases even towns, smaller towns, villages, were attacked by Americans and British with firebombs. And this occurred, although the very first firebombing of a German city occurred in 1943 against Hamburg. This went on all the way to the end of the war, even after the Germans, for all intents and purposes, had lost the war. This was nothing but a deliberate, sadistic attempt to kill every man, woman, and child, pets, animals, everything, in every German city. There was no longer any value to these cities. The industry, it had all gone underground to keep the war effort afloat. And so by this time, 1944, especially in 1945, there simply was no longer any military reason to attack these towns. And so the Americans and the British, of course, at the behest of their Jewish masters, in the case of FDR, that is Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the American president, he was surrounded by Jewish advisors in there who constantly prodded him along. And of course, some of your listeners have probably heard of the Morgenthau Plan. Henry Morgenthau was the Secretary of Treasury under FDR. He was Jewish, and he proposed that Germany simply be wiped off the face of the earth. And I'm not talking in figurative terms either here. I'm talking literally. to kill every German who was alive. And they did their dead level best in the war itself. But anyway, FDR went along with it. He signed on with it, and so did his military commanders, including General Dwight David Eisenhower, the commander of all Allied forces in Europe. They went along with this program. They were all not simply went along with it. They were proponents and enablers of this genocidal attempt to destroy Germany. And of course, whatever they said filtered down quickly to those below them, their officers and the 18-year-olds holding the rifles. And so what we have at the end of the war is not just the firebombing, deliberate, sadistic firebombing of every German city, the most famous, of course, being Dresden. But we also have on the ground a no-quarter policy. Generally, it's a no-quarter policy beginning with D-Day, as soon as the Americans and the British and the French Free Forces, that is, hit the sand on Omaha Beach and the other areas. A deliberate policy began of just killing Germans when they were captured, simply killing them. I know how preposterous that may sound, because we've seen lots of pictures of Germans in the old newsreels behind barbed wire, but most of that is after the war. I'm talking about during the war, while the war is going on, this attempt to it's just basically a black flag operation all the way through France, Belgium, the Netherlands, until they got into Germany, and of course they increased the massacre. I'm talking about German soldiers surrendering and being mowed down, being shot dead. And that goes also for the old men and little boys who formed the German militia, the Volkssturm. And these people are also being killed. Hellstorm talks about this, and it does so in the words of the people themselves. It's a first-person, you-are-their approach. In other words, I'm allowing the people, the survivors, and even those who did not survive, to tell their stories, what it was like to go through this devastating, methodical massacre of their nation. And they tell the story far better than I could, or any author, as far as I'm concerned. They tell the story in their very poignant, passionate words. And the massacres, the firebombings, yes, that takes up a chapter in the book, and the slaughter of the German soldiers and civilians on the land takes up another chapter, or chapter and a half. I'm not sure how long these are, but they come in between other things that I'd never heard of. For instance, the rape. To me, this is the worst aspect of World War II, bar none, because I've always despised rape. But we had always heard about the Soviet Union, the Red Army soldiers committing rape, and there's no denying that. They did. When they came through, they, quite honestly, there were very few women who escaped, either by hiding or fleeing to safety. There was very few places they could flee to safety, as a matter of fact. But these Russian soldiers, the Soviet soldier, the average Red soldier, was encouraged, not just allowed, but encouraged to rape. Ilya Ehrenberg, a Jewish propagandist for Stalin, he encouraged them to rape all the women and children, and when you're through, kill them. In essence, that's what he said. And he's the right-hand man of Stalin, and of course, the Russian soldier, already pissed off about the Germans invading their country and fighting for so long in Russia itself. Many of them had scores to settle. And when you tell an 18-year-old that it's his duty to rape and murder, generally these young people who have not fully developed a soul or a conscience will certainly obey those orders, and they did. But one thing I found out from the research is that the average Red Army soldier, that is the average frontline fighting man, who were a majority of white Russians and Ukrainians and Belarus, people like that, these are the tough ones. They committed atrocities, it's true. There's no doubt about it. All frontline soldiers do. But those who really committed the beastly atrocities and made it a sweeping crime throughout all of Germany was the rear echelon soldiers, that is the supply side soldiers, those who are not in combat. Many of them never hear a bullet fired in anger. They're so far behind the lines. But after the Red Army soldier would move on in eastern Germany, fighting their way across toward Berlin, within a few hours, maybe a few days, but always came the rear echelon soldiers. And after the front line had moved on, the rear echelon came in. And many of these were Asiatics, especially Mongolians. The majority of them were Asiatics, as a matter of fact. And many of them were Mongolians. And these people, the crimes they commit are just almost, like I said earlier, it's you can't even imagine what I'm talking about right now. And I won't go into all of that. But the crimes they committed were just unbelievable. And it should be said that they were unbelievable even to the frontline Russian soldiers. Many, many times, white Russian officers and their men would warn the people after a town had just been captured, look, you guys have got to do something. I'm talking about the villagers or the people in the towns. You've got to move on. You've got to follow behind us because those coming behind us, that is this rear echelon group, they have no mercy whatsoever. Hell will be unleashed upon you. We promise you. So you've got to escape somehow. And that was their attempt to save these poor people who the Red Army soldier knew what was coming behind them. And they just simply, I mean, let's put it this way. The towns they came through, those people who weren't dead were had been raped to the point that they wished they were dead. And the cities were burned down. But anyway, the rape, I could go on about that. And there's, I think Adam, you've read the book and you know what some of the extremes were. And I won't get into that right now. We have enough time to get. Yes, I mean just off the charts.
It's an incredible book, man.
Yeah,
my goodness.
But what I didn't know, though, however, when I was researching and writing Hellstorm, was the degree, the extent of rape over in the Western Front, where the Americans were coming through, the British also, but mostly the Americans. And I'll be honest with you, in summer 1945, I did get this in because you mentioned it was a new book, just came out last year. But yes, in Hellstorm itself, I don't talk much about rape on the Western Front. But since then, I'd done a lot of research for the summer 1945 book, and I found out that there is not a lot of difference between the two sides as far as rape goes. The American officers were also encouraged to allow their men to rape, and not just simply allow them to rape, but encourage them, enable them to rape. And the Americans raped on a prodigious scale that makes me ashamed to be an American, quite honestly. They did some of the same things that the Soviets had done in the East, standing in line to rape women in shops. And here's something else that both sides encouraged their men to do to the German women. Make it public, preferably in front of their family, but more than anything else, it had to be witnessed by people, whether it was out in on a park bench in the middle of the day or whether it was in a store shop, whether it was up against a wall. It had to be a public affair. And, of course, these are the Jewish commissars in the Eastern Front that are encouraging this with their pistols in hands, encouraging and even ordering their men to do this. But the Americans had their own Jewish commissars, D2, the intelligence, what so-called intelligence for the American Army. And they were doing virtually the same thing, encouraging. In fact, over on the American side, when the American Army invaded and occupied a village or a town, officers would go around door to door, forcing the people to write out a list of the names and ages of the people inside the homes and then tack it on their door so that it would be much easier to come in and pick out the girls and the women and the children. And that's what I mean by rape. And rape, I've always thought of rape prior to these books as something private, something hidden, something secret, back in the dark, some dark corner somewhere. One man, one woman. That's not what we're talking about in World War II. We're talking about crowds of people forced to watch. We're talking about lines of men standing there to wait their turn to rape, in some cases until a woman was dead, to keep on raping. And in fact, one of the ugly aspects of this rape was when a woman was so stiff that she couldn't be raped anymore. Someone was ordered to put a rock or a telephone receiver or a stick up her vagina to signify, you know, business closed. That's what I mean. And rape, I've got a new attitude toward rape now, even more hateful than I ever thought it was. I won't go any further than that. But anyway, it talks a lot about the rape, of course, because that was a very prominent aspect of the invasion of Germany by the Soviet Union and the American forces. Other things. Torture. Yeah, that was a very big component of American and Soviet and French occupation. Torture. Torture for torture's sake. Not torture to find any hidden gold or learn valuable business secrets or learn how, you know, where Uncle Billy's watch is buried. Torture just for the sake of torturing somebody, just to hear him scream and yell and beg for mercy. In fact, it was terrible and very prominent over on the American Western side. Of course, everything was turned into a prison seemingly, and the depravity involved, I won't get into that, but the worst tortures of all, at least the worst I have found, were in Poland, in camps operated and run and operated by Jews, former concentration camp prisoners or Jews from America or wherever they escaped to in the 1930s when Hitler came to power. They were running these torture camps, and that's virtually all they were, is torture camps, where death was something to be postponed and life was meant to be to continue with the sadistic torture being inflicted. And of course, you might imagine there's lots of terrible ways of torturing someone. And again, I won't get into that either, because I'm laughing because I don't know what else to do when I start talking about stuff like this. The torture, and it was pervasive, by the way, and it went on for many years. And then there are other components of this book, Hellstorm, that is, the things I'd never heard of. I had always thought that the greatest nautical disasters in world history were either the Titanic or the Lusitania, because we've heard so much about both sinkings of ships. 1,500 people died on the Titanic, 1,200 on the Lusitania, and that's a lot of people to drown in a very short time. But I found during the research of this book that these were really not that large, the number of people who drowned, who died in these other terrible ship sinkings, compared to what happened in World War II with refugee ships filled with Germans trying to escape the Soviet army, thousands of people trying to get on boats, ships, either tankers or freighters, or in some cases old steamships, passenger steamships, trying desperately to escape the Soviet army. And the most terrible of the sinkings was the Wilhelm Gustloff, which was an old steamer, a cruise ship, and it was built for roughly 2,500 passengers and crew. But the night it sailed from the Baltic area in the east, it had somewhere between 9,000 and 10,000 people on board. That's how many people crammed into that ship. And as if it wasn't terrible enough, hellish enough, this was winter, of course. It was freezing, and there was ice in the water. And then you've got three times the amount of people it should be on that ship, which means all the toilets go out quickly. And it means the smell, the nauseating smell of excrement and vomit, and the terrified screams of people who have gotten lost in this mob of people on this ship. If that all isn't bad enough, then shortly after leaving, several hours after leaving, it was hit by two Soviet submarines who knew very well that it was a refugee ship filled with civilians trying to escape. But nevertheless, the Soviet submarine shot two torpedoes into the ship, and ultimately, when it finally did roll over and sink, there were roughly 8,000 to 9,000 people who died, almost all of them. Some of them, I think, were 500 who actually did escape this. But compare that with the Lusitania or the Titanic. 8,000 to 9,000 people, and perhaps even more for all I know, compared to 1,500 or 1,200, far and away the most terrible nautical disaster in world history. And it was not the only ship to go down. The Soviets were sinking everything on the Baltic. And by the way, people who think that, well, perhaps the Soviets thought they were sinking German naval ships, there were no German naval ships of any size still left floating on the Baltic. They knew very well that these ships were refugee ships, taking frightened people to a safer place over in Western Germany. So it was a massacre on the water. There's a massacre on the land, of course, and a massacre in the air, from the air, and now a massacre on the water. But it does talk about, the book does talk about this, and in the words of the people themselves, the ones who experienced these things, and they tell a terrible, terrifying story. But the book also talks about the immediate post-war years, the last 2 years, or the let's call it what it really was. It was war by another name, peace. And it was not peace, of course. It was a time of re-education and denazification and starvation and rape. And it's going on and on and on. It's not letting up at all, really. In fact, for instance, Eisenhower's death camps. Some of your listeners may have never heard of this, but General Dwight David Eisenhower, the ultimate general for the Allies in World War II, and within a few years soon to be an American president, he was one of the most vengeful, hate-filled individuals I've ever read about.
Jewish as well, Tom? Jewish?
Well, some people say that. I have no proof. I have not bothered to even go any further on it, but that might explain his pathological hatred of Germans. He says it time and time again. God, I hate the Germans, he would say. He would write that to his wife. And Eisenhower, I should say, he was a desk general. He was a political appointment. He was a man who never heard a bullet fired in anger. This is the man leading the Allies, the Allied armies. And he made a comment just before the war was over. He said, God, I wish we could have killed more of them. In other words, here's the world's greatest bloodbath, and this man still hasn't gotten enough of it. So Eisenhower wanted to go on killing Germans even if the war was over, and he found a way to do it. Roughly 5 million disarmed German POW soldiers, that is, fell into his hands at the end of the war, and Eisenhower saw a way to kill even more Germans. He simply to avoid the Geneva Convention and the International Red Cross and the few people who still care about any Germans, to avoid any criticism from these areas, he simply stopped calling them POWs and started calling them DEFs, Disarmed Enemy Forces. And that, at least in Eisenhower's mind, gave him all the latitude he needed to do what he wanted with these roughly 5 million helpless, disarmed, exhausted, starving German POWs. And Eisenhower, I hate to say he went to work, because he didn't. He didn't do a damn thing. He just put them into these large open-air enclosures, many of them which were right along the edge of the River Rhine, put them in there, and that was mostly it. If they got fed something, whether it be bird seed or some other rotten type of food that could be distributed or look good to the cameras, he would do that. But for the most part, these men, over the next weeks and months, simply starved to death or died of dehydration, even though the rivers ran, you know, sometimes within a rock's throw of the camp itself, or died of lack of medicine, died of disease, or in many cases just died of simple bullets, murder. And it's been estimated, and this is the best I can do, it sounds legitimate, maybe there's more, but anywhere from 1.5 million, 800,000 to 1.5 million died under Eisenhower's death camps. Let's call them what they were. They were death camps, pure and simple. That's where men were designed to die in, these things that Eisenhower set up. So that's the man we made president in America a few years later. But in essence, that is what Hellstorm is about. Now, there's lots of other things. For instance, again, in the words of the folks themselves who experience things like this, you know, like anyone on a sinking ship, before you go down, you want to just have one more smile, one more piece of joy on this earth before you do go down and drown. And that was the case with the Germans toward the end of the war. They knew they were going to lose. I'm talking about soldiers and civilians. But in this case, I'm just talking about the civilians. And many of the Germans just decided to cast off any morals they had had in a previous life, a better life, and certainly during the war, and do anything they wanted. In this case, I'm talking about drinking, ribaldry, sex. Sex became just a something that everybody witnessed, sex in open places, sex in public. And so there was a lot of this going on. And, well, there were other things. Most people...
The plight of Trekkers in East Prussia was even worse. As isolated Wehrmacht units desperately defended their shrinking Baltic beachheads, millions of refugees poured into the coastal pockets. Unlike the situation at Breslau, military authorities to the north could not simply order superfluous civilians from their lines. With their backs literally to the sea, only the slow and treacherous evacuation by boat was an option. Consequently, at Memel, Königsberg, Kolberg, Danzig, and other besieged cauldrons, the situation was appalling. Jürgen Thorwald describes the chaotic conditions at Pillau, where thousands of refugees sought shelter. Every alley, every street was packed with their vehicles. People were waiting in every harbour shed, in every wind-sheltered corner. Among them stood their beasts, bleating, snorting, lowing. The pregnant women giving birth somewhere in a corner, on the ground, in a barracks. Some of them had been raped on their flight, and now they were trembling for fear they would give birth to a monster. The strangely pale faces of girls going up and down the streets asking for a doctor. The wounded and the sick, in constant fear they would be left behind, concealing weapons under their blankets to force someone to take them along, or to end their own lives if the Russians came. The orphans, who had been saved from their asylum somewhere at the last moment and tossed onto carts with nothing around them but a blanket, and who were now lying on the floors with frozen limbs. The Russian prisoners of war, brought west under orders from above, walking on wooden soles, their tattered overcoats held together with paper strings. The old people who had lain down in some doorway at night and had not awakened. The hungry for life who found each other to mate among the ruins in broad daylight. And the wild-eyed insane ones who rushed from house to house, from wagon to wagon, crying for their mothers or their children. Over it all the grey sky, snow, frost and thaw, and thaw and frost and snow, and the chill, killing wet.